Welcome to Cloud Native Compass, a podcast to help you navigate the vast landscape of the cloud native ecosystem.
We're your hosts. I'm David Flanagan, a technology magpie that can't stop playing with new shiny things.
I'm Laura Santa Maria, a forever learner who is constantly breaking production.
So apparently, CloudRun is better than BigQuery. That is according to principal engineer at ChainGuard, Jason Hall.
In this episode, we get to chat with Jason about ChainGuard's migration from Kubernetes and Knative to CloudRun for a pillar of their infrastructure.
And in this episode, we didn't even mention Rust. Until we did, because Laura brought it up.
Well, you know, I had to do it. Enjoy this episode and try to spot the deepfake Jason. Welcome to the episode. We have a wonderful guest with us. Jason, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. I'm Jason Hall. I work at ChainGuard. I'm an engineer. I do all kinds of stuff, generally backend related. Also a lot of image building stuff. That's kind of what we do there. All over the place.
I've known you for all of 5 minutes, and clearly you're an awesome person. So we're very excited to have
you.
Thank you. 5 minutes. I can learn about some of you in 5 minutes.
I've known him for longer, so I know better, right?
Yeah.
7 minutes. No, I'm only. Yeah. We followed each other at socials for a long time, and I've always loved the work that you're putting out. And what prompted this conversation today is an article that you published to the ChainGuard blog about a migration, some cloud adoption, containers, and CloudRun. And we're going to touch on all of these different aspects. But I love your simple introduction. I'm an engineer that does stuff, back end stuff.
I mean, generally, they don't let me touch the front end.
Oh, okay. I know that feeling. Usually, if I touch prod, everything breaks on purpose. Yeah. Hey, is what I tell everybody.
I've done some Tailwind last week. Like, does that make me feel stacked now?
Yes, it does.
All right, awesome. So I think just to provide a little bit of context before we dive into like the Kubernetes, the containers, and the CloudRun, is like you have a career behind you that required, or I don't know if it required, you had some time at Google along with other ChainGuard engineers, right? So the context here is that you've been working with containers and Kubernetes for a while. Is that a safe assumption?
Yeah. While I was at Google, I worked on the Google Cloud Build product. I started that team with a couple other folks. So that was sort of my introduction to containers in the first place, was how to build them as a service. I learned a lot. I made a lot of mistakes, as everyone does. And they hired me at ChainGuard anyway. So a lot of folks from Google came over to ChainGuard, and our focus there is also building containers, you know, as well as possible, as quickly as possible, serving them as well as possible. A bunch of folks were from the Google container registry team also. So, a bunch of folks there dealing with both building containers and running containers to serve them.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I bring this up, right, and I don't want to condense your article down into one sentence, but I'm going to do it anyway, is that ChainGuard couldn't be arched with Kubernetes anymore. I mean, that's what it boiled down to, right?
I might temper that a little bit, but sure, right? Like, we found that we were not taking full advantage of all of the features that Kubernetes provides, such that it was worth the maintenance and upkeep and, you know, general stuff. You know, like if we were using every feature of Kubernetes, it would have been worth it to stay there. We ended up mostly running a bunch of stateless services, talking to, you know, Cloud SQL and R2 for blob storage, and a bunch of like off cluster services. So we were basically just running a bunch of stateless services inside of Kubernetes, which can be nice, but we weren't finding it to be useful for all that Kubernetes brought to us. So,
I mean, and you were also saying that you had a lot of spiking traffic, and you were running Knative, really, right? So
yeah. So the lineage of the engineering team is also a lot of, you know, Matt and some other folks at ChainGuard started Knative with many other folks, not just them, and so they were deeply, you know, involved in it and knew how it worked and knew how it worked well and where it didn't work well. And Knative wasn't really the problem. I think that, you know, generally it was that, I think that Knative is sort of like the nice deployment API. It's just a good deployment API. I mean, not just, but, so Knative was never the problem. And Knative actually made it easier for us to move to Cloud Run because they had the sort of same API and container contract and all of that. So, yeah, Knative was never really the problem. And Kubernetes wasn't really the problem. The GKE wasn't really the problem. It was that we were not using all the stuff that Kubernetes would let us do. Mm-hmm. We were just running a bunch of stateless services. And there's an easier way to do that, it turns out.
Right. And I also saw in the article, as David eventually hopefully will return and rejoin us. I also saw in the article, though, that you all were basically, instead of having spot instances, you were having to maintain servers running and maintain nodes running and things like that because you had a lot of spiking traffic, but you couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of were stuck with it, with all this infrastructure that you weren't really using unless you had a major spike in something. And that really doesn't make much sense if you're doing a lot of stateless systems. So,
yeah. So our traffic is very spiky. And like I mentioned in the article, a lot of that traffic just comes from us. Like we tried, our main thing is we're just trying to build images as quickly and as fast as possible. Right. But in doing that, we also have to push them to the registry and then pull them again to scan them and pull them again to test them. And so when a new image is built, there's like a little mini flurry of activity around it on the back end, on the infrastructure. Multiply that by an ever increasing number of images. And basically we'd had like, you know, over time, these spikes got bigger. In order to absorb those spikes, we kept it, you know, did the normal thing you do, which is to keep a warm pool of nodes and instances ready to absorb them. Which, you know, you can turn the dial between like cost and reliability. We turned it towards cost and reliability, or sorry, raising cost and raising reliability. But we knew that if sort of that trend was going to keep going, we would need to figure out a cheaper way to do that sort of thing. Again, we had a lot of folks that already, you know, knew Cloud Run, worked on Cloud Run, worked near Cloud Run. And so we from the start had sort of thought that was a good idea to migrate toward.
I don't know if you noticed, but I had to rejoin. My Linux crashed, as it always fucking does. So if my question now seems to take us on a wild tangent, it's not intentional. It's just because I missed about 45 seconds. No, I was going to put my serious face on for a moment, right? Because I was very dismissive of Kubernetes at the start and saying that you couldn't be arsed with it. But, something I feel very guilty of is I go to conferences and meet people and say, you know, Kubernetes gives you all this stuff for free, but there is a very real tax to running and operating a Kubernetes cluster. And I feel like that is, if you're not using the whole thing, like you were saying, you know, sometimes that tax isn't worth the burden. And I think that's an important lesson for people to walk away with is like, you know what you're getting into. Even the people that have all of this experience in containers and Kubernetes sometimes just don't want to pay that tax for what they need. And I don't know if it was mentioned, but Cloud Run is, it's a fantastic product. I run a bunch of things on it myself. And then, you know, we can dive into that in more detail, but.
I think similarly, like Kubernetes also gives you a lot of knobs to tune and optimize things, which is great when you are at, you know, a level of scale that you need to tune and optimize those things and have the expertise and the sort of, you know, interest and time to prioritize that. We didn't take advantage of most of those knobs. And in fact, most of those knobs were like hard for us to like know how to use correctly, I think, or at least me. So, we didn't really use a lot of them. We wanted a simpler, just run this stateless service, scale it up as you see fit type of thing. And that was exactly what Cloud Run was for us.
Yeah. So I am curious, right? Obviously, while we're talking about the migration from your blog, and we'll put the link to this in the show notes for anyone who's listening in the description for anyone watching on YouTube. But this is for your ChainGuard public registry, right? This is serving infrastructure that delivers images to people. Do you have other infrastructure that is still running Kubernetes, or is, you know, is this like your main operational project?
Yeah, I'd say there are, roughly speaking, as of right now, three infrastructure-y type things we run. One is serving images and everything that it takes to serve images, auth, data store, a lot of like eventing and PubSub internal stuff to do stuff when stuff happens. That's the first pillar is like sort of, I'll call it serving. And that's what this blog post was about and our migration to Cloud Run was about. We also have a bundle of infrastructure for building packages. At ChainGuard, we build every package from source ourselves. And so when a new, you know, Python release drops, we build that Python release and build an APK that ends up in an image. That infrastructure does still run on Kubernetes. And I think we get a lot of benefit from Kubernetes. We use all those knobs. We use all the, you know, we use all of the features that are in there. So that second one, package builds, is still in Kubernetes. The third one is image builds. So when we build an image from these packages, we take, you know, the Python image contains both the Python package and, you know, CA certs and libcrypto and things like that. We take these distinct packages and put them into an image and push them. That infrastructure is mostly at some part just HTTP and tar. Like, we just fetch APKs, stitch them together into images, and then push them, and then test them, and then scan them, and do a bunch of stuff downstream. So the three of them sort of, and then when it pushes it to the serving infrastructure. So all three are sort of living together next to each other, dependent on each other. Yeah, the package build infrastructure still uses Kubernetes, is very reliant on it. It takes, you know, I think full advantage of all of the stuff that Kubernetes gives us, but the serving infrastructure wasn't really. And so we moved that one to Cloud Run.
Makes sense.
Nice. Now, you did something with Cloud Run, which I believe it now does it out of the box, but I'm assuming your efforts predate that, which is the ability to do multi-region deployments. So maybe you could go into that and tell us, you know, because you're using R2 as like the blob storage that powers the serving infrastructure. That is powered by Cloudflare, distributed around the world, lower than latency to first byte for all your customers. So having multi-region deployments makes a lot of sense. So how about you kind of dive into how you did that, architected that, and deployed it?
Yeah.
So the multi-region Cloud Run service module that we have is basically a wrapper around run this Cloud Run service in three regions, right? Or in N regions. As far as I know, and that does predate the Cloud Run providing this feature by itself. As far as I know, and if someone from the Cloud Run team is screaming at this, telling me that I'm wrong, I think that the Cloud Run feature of a global service is basically like syntactic sugar around run three regional, and regional versions of this, and you can stitch them together with GCLB or load balance across them. So our Terraform module for this and Cloud Run's feature, I think, are more or less the same architecture of like, I want to run this in three places, and I want GCLB to figure out which one is closest to the user. A lot of our services, so the registry, for instance, when you ask to pull an image, we route that to the closest region to you. So if you're on the West Coast, West Coast of the US, it will hit the West Coast replica. It will do some sort of auth check and say like, oh, you're David, I know you, you're allowed to pull this image. And then it will, as quickly as possible, redirect you to R2 to get that blob. We want you off of our lawn as quickly as possible. We want you to be, you know, talking to R2, pulling that blob without us doing anything. So as much as is possible, we'd like to handle that request as close to you as possible, do as little work as possible in as little time as possible, and then say, your blob's in R2, go get it from them.
Right.
But as far as I know, that the Cloud Run global service feature is, you know, infrastructure and niceness around run this same thing in three places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually deployed my first native multi-region Cloud Run a couple of weeks ago. And I was disappointed to see that I got three different URLs back for each deployment and then had to manually go and configure my own load balancing for it. So I think it's still very early. I mean, it's either alpha or beta. It's very early for what they're doing. And I don't think all of the niceties are quite there yet. But I think you're right. It's the same model that you've done with your Terraform module, only probably a little bit better because you have an open source Terraform module that other people can go steal and do this themselves as well. So.
Yeah. And if the Cloud Run, as the Cloud Run product improves, there's nothing in about our Terraform modules that requires them to be done this way. If there is a global Cloud Run service resource, we would just use that, you know, and I think for the most part, depending on a lot of details, like things would just work. Think, you know, the next time you Terraform apply, it would just become a global service or whatever. But yeah.
Right.
But I'm assuming the way that this works is like you get through the networking layer, it's probably like an Anycast IP, or maybe it does DNS for the route into the lowest latency, right? I take it as just like the serving Cloud Run function is just a piece of Go code that signs an R2 URL and then you're handing off, right? That's what you said. You want it out of that as soon as possible with the caller. So.
Yeah. We do, you know, auth checks and as whatever we need to do to make sure that you're allowed to get this R2 URL, and then we generate a signed URL for you and redirect. That's also because not just for latency, not just to get you to R2 as fast as possible. But if we serve from R2, then it's zero egress, like egress is free. So we don't want to like proxy that blob through our service, because then we would pay, you know, egress for that. So we just say, you're good, we know you, go talk to R2 and get your blob from them.
Yeah, and the zero egress fees is so appealing with R2. I feel like they're going to rug pull that at any minute, and I hope not any minute soon, because I just uploaded a terabyte of video to it that I want to start, you know, putting on my website. But it just, especially in today's day and age, right, where every major cloud provider is charging us through the nose for egress, and Cloudflare's just sitting there like, yeah, we don't care. As long as it goes direct through R2 or their CDN, they don't care. And
I definitely agree that it feels too good to be true, and maybe it will turn out to be too good to be true. But for now, I'm very happy that it exists, and I'm happy to sit on this rug for now. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what exactly is going on underneath the covers, or underneath the rug, I guess you could say, that's making this a good business decision somewhere down the line. Because, you know, is it just because someone really, 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 really wants to twist the knife on like AWS or somebody, just saying like, ha ha, see, this is what we can do that you can't do it? Or is it like, honestly, they're going to use it to push some other product out there? I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting question how they're doing it and why they're doing it. Because
When you're Cloudflare, right, and you've got probably every enterprise company in the world paying the big money for the top end, that egress transfer on this and the storage means nothing. I'm assuming, right? I don't know anything about Cloudflare internally, but I'm assuming they're just like, yeah, you know, I mean, Google and AWS are probably paying them a ton of money for other stuff. So, like,
yeah. So if there's a Cloudflare, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. My understanding of how like network egress billing works anyway is that like Google and Amazon don't pay that much to be able to shift bits around, right? They just feel like charging you a bunch for it. Right. And Cloudflare also doesn't get charged that much to move the bits around. They just don't feel like charging you for it, which, you know, it's not like they're losing money on it, I hope.
Right.
There are a lot of their competition and their following suit as well. You know, Bunny.net is a CDN with zero egress fees, or very, very competitive egress fees. Sivo Cloud started doing zero egress fees. So maybe it will have a knock-on effect. But I don't want us to start going down that rabbit hole and talking about something else.
I've got other rabbit holes
I want to push us down.
If there is a Cloudflare person who works on this, who's listening and feels like coming onto a podcast, maybe reach out. We're kind of curious. Anyway, but I kind of want to switch a little bit, because I noticed that you had been talking a lot about basically about leased access as you were building out these they're not clusters, services, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So your service account is very, very minimal, and then everything is working, and I'm kind of reading the article as we're talking. You're doing explicit authorization and doing all of the really, really good things that are good security practices. Was this a problem to kind of figure out with as you move off of Kubernetes systems that are a little more designed to work together, figuring out the architecture to make that service system work? I'm curious, mostly as someone who hasn't really done a whole lot of going back and forth between a Kubernetes cluster and serverless functions. Usually I'm just running serverless stuff. I'm not doing both at the same time. So I'm curious how that works.
Yeah. The first thing you mentioned, that the having like in our service module, the service account has no permissions by default. You have to explicitly grant it, right. You know, every permission. That I totally understand why Cloud Run the regular Cloud Run service comes with a regular service account that has, I think, fairly broad permissions. Like for people onboarding to your service, you don't want to say like, in the 5 minutes I have your attention, first figure out IAM and what exact, you know, permissions this thing needs. where are you going? Why are you leaving? You know, so they by default give you a very powerful service account to run with by default, which mm-hmm. totally makes sense for onboarding and new users. But then that's terrible when you generally the route that goes is you onboard one service with a bunch of permissions, you onboard five more, you onboard 30 more. And then you realize, oh my God, everything has permission to do everything. And this is, you know, somebody in security notices and makes you fix that after the fact. Right. Ask me how I know about this, this route of how things go. So we very early on decided, like, if we're going to migrate to this thing, we want to do it right from the start. We want to there is no way to get this super powerful service account on this service without explicitly saying like, yeah, this should be able to do everything, which none of them ever do. Nothing ever needs all those things. So we, in the list of, in the modules in that repo, there is a couple of things. One is authorize a service to call another service. So given two services, you can say like, this service here is allowed to talk to this service here. And one really clever thing, which I think Matt did, was the only way to get an address to the destination service is to call the authorize this service module. So needs to call B, there is a way around. You can the easiest way to get the address for B is to call the authorize service module. And as a result, the output of that is the address for B. So if you're trying to call B and you're like, how do I find B? You find it by authorizing right. So therefore, like, you know, as a fun like side effect, you have also explicitly authorized A to call B, which is very nice and something we take advantage of a lot. The other thing is like that's like service to service communication and authorization. If there's a service that needs to talk to KMS or to get a cloud secret or to, you know, make a request to a cluster or anything like that. Because when you create the service, you also have to create the service account that runs in there. You have the handle to say like, okay, this thing that's running this service is going to also need permission to read a secret, permission to, right. you know, sign with KMS, as opposed to create a service and then try to figure out what service account it had, or you like find the auto created one and twiddle its permissions. I think that's just sort of a nice, a lot of things in there were done thoughtfully to make the default thing you do secure, like not just for secure defaults, but so that also that like the easiest path to get your job done is also happens to be the secure way to do it.
Right.
Which I think was really nice. And we've definitely like taken advantage of that all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. When you make the easy path, the secure path, that's always a good design decision. So.
Well, and in a code review, right? Like you can see that somebody's, you know, jumping through eight hoops to get the address to B instead of just authorizing it. And you can sort of tell like, this is an awkward way to do this. Why didn't you just call the easy way? Why did you walk around the building to get there? You know?
So. Yeah. Yeah, makes sense.
So let's dig into the authorization stuff a little bit more. Now, I don't understand. I don't know the commercial side of the Chingar business here, right? Does anyone with a login can pull any image as many times as they want? Or does the authorization and authentication go a bit deeper than that, where certain organizations can pull certain images with a certain number of times? Like, are you using SpiceDB or anything based on the Zanzibar paper, or is it like a flat authorization across the board?
Great question. We don't have rate limits for anything, for our public free tier, developer tier images, or paying customers. We have no rate limits. All of that comes with the caveat that every service has a rate limit imposed by physics. So you can't possibly, you can't send us 10 trillion requests a second. Something will blow up. But we try not to impose artificial rate limits on anything. And a lot of that comes from, like we were talking before, using R2. It's not like you pulling our image, 1,000 times is going to cost us 1,000 times more than the first time. So by all means, pull away. We don't use SpiceDB. We have our own IAM model that we base heavily on Kubernetes' and GCP's IAM model. It's a lot, I think, simpler, or at least simpler for now. We don't have hundreds of roles or hundreds of permissions. We have, I think, maybe a dozen. But ask again in 3 years and see if we're up to the 350,000 roles that IAM roles that GCP or AWS has.
Okay, cool.
Interesting.
All right. So now I don't know if you were being polite or naive, right? I think that's the two choices we have. But you talked about Google's default service account for like Cloud Run functions being permissive, and it's, you don't want to scare people away in the first 5 minutes. I always thought it was a bit more sinister. Not sinister, it's a terrible word. It's like they want you to be able to go and use all the other cloud products, right? They want you to hook into CloudScale. Yeah. They want you to use BigQuery. They want you to, it's just like, yeah, sure. Yeah, free, use whatever you want. The bill just keeps going up and up and up. Like, woo, go nuts. You and ChainGuard as a whole, the big you, you do hook into more of GCP services. I've seen BigQuery on the article, and you mentioned CloudSQL as well. So, like, is that, again, an operational concern where you didn't want to take on the burden of running your own Postgres's, et cetera? Or were you always just going to use cloud products first? Like, I'm curious about that decision process.
Yeah, I think in general, I think it makes sense to think about whether your expertise is database maintenance, whether the company differentiates, the business differentiates on how well it can manage a SQL database. And if that is your competitive advantage, and there are definitely businesses and companies that is their competitive advantage, then by all means run it yourself, right? ChainGuard's not differentiating on how well it can run a database. So we just want one that works and is reliable and, relatively low touch to get the job done. I'm sure it's not optimized to the ends of the earth. I'm sure there's stuff we could do that if we wanted to make it hum a little better. But, ultimately that's not where we differentiate from anybody else. On the other side, like building the best images possible is where we differentiate. And so we have invested a lot in on that side, right? And if we had spent a bunch of time building our own database, building our own AMS, building our own secret store, build all of this stuff, which, as an infra nerd, I would love to, right? Like, please let me go do this. But instead they tell me I have to like build images or something. It's about like really trying to think about where your time is most useful. And managing our own Postgres was not that. So we luckily had Cloud SQL right there. We pulled it off the shelf. We use it. If at some point our database becomes our bottleneck, and sometimes it is, but if it becomes our biggest fire, like we will invest in making that better and tuning it better. And if that means we run it ourselves, then that means we run it ourselves. But I don't think that would be our first choice.
You did mention, not to put you on the spot, right? But you did mention at the start that some of this migration was also cost driven. And like, Maybe it's just a Scottish person in me, right? But we're known globally as quite tight-fisted people. We're cheap. I keep looking at the price of vCPUs and managed Postgres, and I'm like, I'm gonna make this at home. And I often will run my databases on bare metal or a virtual machine, even though the operational costs are astronomical because I have to do my own backups and stuff. But
yeah,
I mean,
but you have the knowledge for it. Not a
cheap product.
But David, you have the knowledge for it. Like, it's a business decision, right? Like, in the end, this is a business decision. You're evaluating the cost of buying versus the cost of managing a team. Like, having dedicated people who may be busy or not busy. They may just kind of be sitting there. I don't know. Like, this is how I always looked at it. You can look at it the same way as, let's say, if you have a lawn, if you have grass, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Depends on where you live. Do you mow it yourself? How much is your time worth? Versus do you pay for a lawn care service? Everybody has a different risk question there. But how much is your hourly pay, David? Think about it that way. And like, how much is that hourly pay and maintaining all of the tooling and maintaining all of those things versus calling somebody who's a specialist who has the really big tools? So I look out at the lawn that we have in the backyard of the house that we rent, and sure, we could get like a little push lawnmower and one of us could spend time mowing that lawn. Or we could pay a service that has one of those massive ride-on lawnmowers, which I think are really cool and I keep wanting to get on when they're not looking, but they don't notice me. And they come and they do it in like 10 minutes, what would take me at least an hour. And then I have to also get rid of all the stuff that's there. It's the same idea of, do I run my own Postgres server and my own Postgres database, knowing that maybe I don't have the best understanding of how it works, so therefore, who knows how secure I really am because I'm doing it myself? Or do I buy it until I can get to the point where I can hire the people and have a team that can maintain it? That's really the business question. Maybe I'm wrong, David. You can correct me, but this is like how I've always looked at this. So
no, I agree. And you mentioned at the end, like hiring folks to do that. There's also a recruiting and expertise sort of question, yeah, right? Like we and this is related to what our differentiated, you know, our value proposition is, but like, we haven't really hired database tuning experts. We haven't really hired, you know, Postgres operators experts. We could do it. I'm sure we could muddle through, and, you know, if David can do it, then anybody can, but, sorry, but, you know, we would rather spend that limited resource of time and energy on, you know, the product and on improving the build pipeline and improving the, you know, serving infrastructure that is differentiated from other folks.
And there's a hidden cost. Right. Well,
let's back up a minute. Recruiting. Hold on.
I didn't mean it.
Yeah, David's like, I have to get my revenge here. Hold on a minute.
No. But what the CNCF wants us all to believe is that we just run a Kubernetes cluster, we stick the Cloud Data PG operator on it, or any operator for any software, and this is all done for us. No expense here, right? Open source is wonderful. Like,
okay. There is such a thing as a, you know, free as in beer or free as in puppies. Like,
yeah.
Where can I get a free puppy?
Hey, I know plenty of places to send you one, but, you know, free puppy doesn't mean forever free. It's an illusion.
I think there's also a when it works well, it's free. When it's, you know, I can, in the 5-minute tutorial timeline, like spin up Cloud Native PG and have it running and do a hello world and insert, you know, 1,000 rows and feel good. Day two is another thing. And then day, you know, 390 is another one that, like, oh no, it was really easy to insert 1,000 rows. It's also easy to insert 20 million rows. And now what? And so not that we wouldn't have this problem on a managed database either, right? We still do, but at least we don't have to, there's a lot of operating stuff that we don't have to care about.
See, yeah, I know David is explicitly nerd sniping a little bit. He's doing it on purpose, and I'm falling into it just as much as anybody else.
Hey, I'm just enjoying us talking. That's no sniping. Uh-huh. But I will say, right, you mentioned something like obviously, you know, people listening, they're making these decisions every day. Do I go and pay for the managed service? Do I get an operator? Do we run it ourselves, right? And Jason's already gave us great advice. Focus on what your company needs to excel at, right? I think that's ubiquitous. Everyone should take that away. But we are missing something here, right? It's easy for me to say I'm going to run my own Postgres when it gets like 10 queries a week or 10 queries an hour or whatever that number is. So maybe, you know, you don't mention this in the article, and I don't know if I want to put you on the spot and say give us numbers, right? But I'm assuming your scale isn't in the hundreds of requests per day, probably not even in the thousands of requests. I'm assuming we're going higher. I don't know how much you're willing to share there, but, you know, any context you want to provide?
PainGuard gets more traffic than my personal blog, if that is the question you are asking.
Nice.
I think the answer to everything is it depends, right? Like, I'm going to put on my senior engineer hat and say it depends.
I knew that was coming.
If this is you are receiving more traffic than you can handle, you figure out why, you figure out what the solution is. If you are not currently experiencing that problem, go fix the problem you are currently experiencing, right? It's never set in stone. It's never, you know, we're never, even this, you know, even while I was writing the article about our migration to Cloud Run, we were making new changes to that stuff. We were like adding new stuff and tweaking stuff and moving stuff around. So it's never, even now it's not done. It was just sort of a birthday, like 1 year since we started this. You may look at this, if you're reading this in the year 2026, listener, you may go back and look at this blog post and say like, oh, it's all different now, right? Like, it's all, you know, they said that they did everything this way and now they're using magical global Cloud Run services and GCLB is deprecated and, you know, whatever. So, it's never done.
Yeah.
All right. I know
we're getting to the end. I want to just highlight one thing. This was a lot of technical debt that you had to convince leadership to let you go fix. That's a lot to pay down that you had to kind of catch up on to be able to say, hey, we need time to be able to go do this. In like 30 seconds, how did you do it? Because that is like the holy grail of like every infrastructure team ever, is convincing your leadership that, hey, we need to completely change what we're doing now that we've scaled differently. So
yeah, it's complicated.
I thought
it
so.
Depends. It helped a lot that we. I'm gonna throw Matt under the bus. Matt is our CTO and sort of, you know, originally led this decision. Having him on board from the start was helpful, right? Like, it was his idea. It wasn't like our idea, and then we had to convince him. He did a fairly thorough cost analysis of like, this is what it costs now to run both the prod environment, the staging environment, and everyone's developer environments. I think this is too much. And I think the trend, you know, going up means it will get worse the longer we put it off. So that definitely helped. He also just sort of started doing it, like not like migrating us for real, but like demonstrating, hey, this is how easy it is to run the service in Cloud Run instead of on Knative. Here's how easy it is to get GCLB to work. I think it was like a weekend of hacking for him, or maybe a week, to like get a demo environment that was entirely in Cloud Run. Not production ready, not ready to start migrating to, but like, hey, it's not as hard as you think. It won't be a 9-month, you know, gigantic engineering slog to do. If we rip the Band-Aid relatively quickly, we can, you know, get this done and make the line go down instead of up. All of those are very helpful ways to convince folks that these are useful migrations and not just engineers being nerd sniped and loving migrating for migrating's sake. Not that I've ever done that. Sort of like forecasting the cost, understanding the cost now and forecasting it and saying, if we don't do anything, this will be a cost in a year. If we do it now, then we upfront that cost and have much less over time.
Right. All right.
I got one more question for us. Now, again, you just mentioned dev environments. Now, a common challenge when I'm, you know, talking to people or working with companies is the more they move to the cloud, typically their development environments get a little bit harder, right? It's not just running a Go binary that speaks to a local Postgres, which is okay for cloud SQL, but when you're using KMS for secrets, you're using PubSub for, you know, webhook receivers and all these other bits and pieces. Maybe you can talk about the developer experience of working on this on your own machine and how that compares to what you ship to production.
Yeah. Every engineer that has, you know, that touches the infrastructure has their own developer environment. In this case, developer environment means GCP project, cloud run service, you know, Constellation, Cloud SQL, KMS, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to run this, if you want to run any of this locally, most of the time you can. If it talks to KMS, you need to, like, you know, set up the auth to be able to do that. If it talks to Cloud SQL, whatever, you need to do that. But if it's just, you know, two services talking to each other or a service talking to R2 to create a signed URL or something, you can run it locally. I think generally it's gotten easy enough to run in Cloud Run that we just do that. Like if it's as easy to get the real actual environment up as it is to run it, you know, two or three services locally and talking to each other, then we'll just put it in the real one and run it there. It's not like as easy as running it locally a lot of times, but generally, like, if you're about to do something that integrates with another service or Cloud SQL or KMS or R2, like, just run it in Cloud Run and it's fine. That was actually a big benefit of this in the first place, was that, like, everyone's developer environment was a significant cost when we had, you know, Kubernetes clusters, two or, you know, multiples of them in each developer environment, not just in terms of, like, unused infrastructure, but, like, okay, it's been 3 months since I last had to make an infra change. First, I have to get my cluster back, like, into a working state, right? I'm going to spend a whole day just, like, kind of getting the cluster back into a workable state, and then I can finally start working on my service. With Cloud Run, there's a lot less bit rot happening underneath you. It's just sort of that service, not none, but a little, you know, most of that service is already just sort of running there, and it costs nothing while you're not using it, which no one, you know, I think my developer environment gets less traffic than my personal blog.
Yeah, I love that's awesome. The scale for all of our conversations. It's like, yeah. Jason's blog. Yeah. In the middle. Yeah. And it's
less than is it bigger or smaller than my blog?
All right, well. Thank you so much for sharing all that. I mean, yeah. We don't even talk about BigQuery, but I don't really want to keep you too much longer. But, you know,
I got nowhere to be.
I don't have a real job, so I mean, I can sit here for as long as you want. But and yeah, Laura got made unemployed, so I guess we're sat here for a while.
Well, just for another 36 hours, I guess. So.
Oh wow!
Yeah, that nice. Long.
All right, so we're here for 36 more hours. Keep it rolling.
All right, let's do this. Live stream time. Anyway.
Well, there's this ongoing meme online, right? Like, when people, I don't know if you've ever searched for, like, Cloud Run and BigQuery. I do this regularly as I'm exploring. But people often argue over what is the best GCP service between Cloud Run and BigQuery. Mm. They're, like, they're both exceptional products.
People with are a cost arguing that isn't over...
Not arguing, but there's a debate, because Cloud Run and BigQuery give you so much for free. Like, they're both stupid, amazing products.
And so which one?
Yeah, have it.
Which one's more valuable is what I guess people are arguing. Now, this is interesting because I don't get involved in these meme arguments. Meme argument, is that like a thing? I just kind of exist and find out about these things on the fringes of the internet when you tell me about them. So.
Well, yes, it's not common, because that would be tragic, right? If people are just going on to Google and going, which one's better? But, you know, when it comes down to all of GCP's products, I think that the two shining torches are Cloud Run and BigQuery. They both cost pennies at really decent scale. And BigQuery is one of these things that I've never personally had a use case to really dive into properly, because, again, I'd be, you know, throwing a tennis ball down a large collider or whatever. I don't, that's a horrible analogy, but I didn't have anything, right? So yeah, I was just curious about the BigQuery stuff. Like, at what point do you decide, yeah, we're going to use BigQuery? Because I've never been there personally, and I'd love to know more.
Yeah, we, for the record, I would say Cloud Run is the better service, and I will fight you if you disagree. I'm just kidding. We probably not. Also don't use, I'm not, I'm really not.
That's the title of the episode now. Jason says Cloud Run is better than BigQuery.
There we go.
Hey man, I don't need people finding me on the internet.
Everyone's going to go to your blog, and then you're going to have to come up with a new scale.
But, there we go.
I have to run Postgres now. What was I saying? We probably also don't use BigQuery for something that actually needs BigQuery. There's also the meme of like your data set fits in memory. You know, like if you are, you don't need, you know, BigQuery and managed services for nearly everything you use it for. We probably don't. But again, the nice thing is that it's a managed service that we just sort of like plop data into and can query later. That could be Cloud SQL. I think we just like having not having to care about the scale of these things and just toss it into BigQuery and it works. One thing we use BigQuery heavily for, which I do like a lot, is our eventing infrastructure. We didn't get to talk much about our eventing infrastructure, but basically, like, you know, when a push happens, when an image push happens, an event is fired inside of our system and it bounces around and things can subscribe to it. That's built on PubSub. One of the subscribers to that PubSub is a recorder that records every event into BigQuery. So every thing that happens, every time anything happens, it is emitted into the event pipe and recorded. And so that is something that's really nice. And we don't even think about it. Like, most of the time, it's just like there is a log of every event somewhere. But when you want to go find that, and when you want to say like, oh, a GitHub pull request was opened that was approved, that did this, that pushed this image, that did this, you have this sort of log of everything to quickly go through and visualize. We also use these things for like, generating dashboards and graphs of like, are people, which customers are pulling which images and which free tier images are most popular and things like that. So,
I bet your security team really loves that though, because one of the biggest things about logging that I always find people don't realize is you need a read-only archive that no one can actually change. Every single logging system should have a read-only archive of everything. That way, if somebody does access the system, because usually what they'll try to do is they'll go in and then they'll change the logs so that they hide their tracks. But if it's pre-logged into BigQuery, they can't go in and just change it, hopefully. Maybe they could.
If they have the right permissions. But anyone can do anything. But yeah,
I know. But like, I like to dream. That's a possibility. I don't know.
But to your point, the recorder service that you know listens to every event and writes it to BigQuery is the only service that has, or the only account that has access to write to that data set.
Yeah.
We also have an alert set up for if any user besides this modifies the data set or reads certain GCS buckets or does certain things that they shouldn't be doing. We call them the lasers. Matt calls them the lasers. You will trip a laser and like fire an alert and notify our Slack that like someone was editing that data set in BigQuery. That's weird, right?
Yeah.
You can also turn off the lasers. A sufficiently, smart person or motivated person could disable the lasers, but it's nice to have another sort of like layer of defense there.
Yeah, always a good thing.
Yeah, but the attack vector here is internal. So I guess there's also... Yeah. It's you're not looking for malicious activity on the outside trying to deactivate your lasers like a casino robbery or anything like that.
It tends to show up with a Slack alert went off that like some coworker was touching this GCS bucket or something, and they'll respond to that in Slack and say, yeah, that was me. I was debugging this thing. This is what that laser is overly sensitive. We should detune it so that it's not gonna bug Slack every time I check my email or something.
I wish I could know when they check their email though. That would be nice.
They're just avoiding us.
I know.
All right. I mean, anyway. I guess the GCS bucket thing ties into your usage of Terraform as well, which we didn't really talk about other than the fact that there's a module. But I'm assuming all your state files live in Terraform. So if anyone were to go in there and start manipulating that, there would be a laser as well. I like this concept of lasers. Yeah. I would have to start building lasers.
We have there's examples in the repo of our lasers around certain things. If a human accesses a service account key, like that is a laserable event. That is something that a person should never be doing. Even if they have permission to, we don't want you to be unrecorded doing that. Yeah.
See, this is something that you've told David this now, and this is how we get Skynet. Is David's just
good? It's about time.
Anyway. All right, I think we should finish on something controversial. So,
we haven't been being controversial. Okay,
sure. Well, I already said Pokemon's better than BigQuery.
I mean, we've ticked off the meme, right? Now we could drop into open source OSI definitions and talk about why Terraform over OpenTofu.
Have we argued about Go and Python yet? We haven't done that yet this episode.
No,
Go and Rust. Python no, Rust. Wins. Rust. Go it home. Was Rust. It was Rust that we need to talk about. Right. We almost have all the memes going. Okay.
We almost made it one episode without me having to say Rust, Laura, and then you poke the bear.
Poke, 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 poke. Anyway. So what were you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, back on track. We're almost done with this thing, right? Why not OpenTofu? Was that even in consideration, or is it like you don't see the...
It is a consideration. I would say mainly we are still floating on inertia of having used Terraform so far. I don't think any of us have any reason not to use OpenTofu. A couple of, or at least one person at ChainGuard, John, has contributed to OpenTofu to make it faster, to make it more performant. And I think we would love to migrate to it. It's just another migration to consider and prioritize with the rest. We have nothing but love for OpenTofu. And we'll migrate to it whenever we can. Awesome. That wasn't that controversial. See, you need to come up with more controversial questions.
But I guess you could say, so you have nothing for love but for OpenTofu, but there's a but in there.
Oh, well.
Okay, there's the controversy. Anyway, I'll stop now.
It's all right. We'll deepfake his voice and put in something spicy.
So. Okay, good.
There's AI. We added AI into this. Okay, what else do we need to add in going on right now? If you said crypto,
all right. No, hang up. This has been really cool. You know, it's a really interesting project. The blog is fantastic. Yeah. People should go read it. The open source modules examples, I think, are universally adoptable and stealable to anyone listening that just wants to go and do some of this stuff, which is really awesome as well. I'll finish. I mean, I don't know if Laura has anything else, but I'll say I'll finish with this. I keep saying one more question and then giving you like another six, but you know, you've said twice now that if we come back in 12 months or 3 months, it'll all be different. I'm curious, over the next 3, 6, and 9 months, what is what's your next mission? What do you think will change? What are you wanting to experiment with? Like, what's on your roadmap?
Focus. I have to only do one thing for each of these things. I mentioned the three sort of pillars of infrastructure we have. The serving infrastructure, I think, is really solid. We just recently are wrapping up sort of an investment in our package build infrastructure. I think the image build infrastructure is the next oldest pillar. Maybe we'll just bounce between all three and just like keep improving them in shifts. But the image build infrastructure is something I think I would love to start improving more. I don't think that will be a 3 or 6 month timeline thing. I would love for it to be. What was the rest of your question?
Focus.
Yeah. Focus. Right. I mean, there's so many shiny things.
You said one thing because this is why you're shipping and I'm sitting here. I've got 12 plates that you can't see off camera that I have to go spin. That's why I had to reconnect and everything. That's like, I can't stop messing with everything. So I really, it always amazes me when people are able to play, we're going to do this one thing and do it. And I'm just like,
I think my coworkers listening to this and hearing you say that I'm very good at focus will be laughing very, very much.
Then they need to go work with David for a little while and then see it all.
I hope that I've, place yeah.
I mean, have you
I
even
bought a given domain everyone today?
Have what?
I haven't.
Have you even bought a domain today? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's early. It's early here. There's plenty of time.
Yep, there you go. There you go. Well, my one thing is just, hey, congratulations on getting through like some technical debt fixes for infrastructure that like that is the holy grail for every operations person ever. So congratulations on surviving that.
Yeah, there's plenty more where that came from too.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, every little bit of debt that we can pay down is always quite nice.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. Any final departing words for the audience before we say goodbye?
No.
Well, now I've known you for an hour and I still think you're a cool person. So thank you so much for coming on. Yeah.
I'll try harder next time.
Okay.
All right. We'll look back at 12 months to see what's changed. Hope you all have a good day.
Take care. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for joining us.
If you want to keep up with us, consider subscribing to the podcast on your favorite podcasting app or even go to cloudnativecompass.fm.
And if you want us to talk with someone specific or cover a specific topic, reach out to us on any social media platform.
Until next time, when exploring the cloud native landscape, on three.
On three.
One, two, three. Don't forget your compass.
Don't forget your compass.